You mean other than the Grey King? Carlo snorted. This Grey King mess will be over in a few months, Bug. One lone madman against 3,000 knives, all answering to Barsavi. The Grey King is a walking corpse. The spider isn't so easily gotten rid of. Which, said Locke, is exactly why we're hoping to see Don Salvara jump 6 feet in the air when he finds us waiting in his study. Because the Blue Bloods are no more comfortable with surprise visits from Midnighters than we are. I hate to interrupt, said Jean, but did you shave this time? Ah, good. With a small stick, he applied a glistening smear of transparent paste to Locke's upper lip. Locke wrinkled his nose in disgust. With a few quick finger motions, Jean placed the false moustache and pressed it home. In a second or two, it was set there as firmly as if it had grown naturally. This gum is made from the inner hide of a wolf shark, Jean explained for Bug's sake, and last time we used it, we forgot to pick up some of the dissolving spirit. And I had to get rid of the moustache in a hurry, said Locke. And damned if he didn't scream when Jean did the honours, said Carlo. Like a Sansa brother in an empty whorehouse. Locke made a rude gesture at Carlo. Carlo mimed aiming and loosing a crossbow at him in return. Scar, moustache, hair, are we done here? Jean packed the last of the disguise implements away in the mask box. That should do it, yes. Locke stared at his reflection in the large mirror for a moment, and when he spoke next, his voice had altered, subtly deeper, slightly rougher. His intonation was the bored humorlessness of a watch sergeant dressing down a petty offender for the 1,000th time in his career. Let's go tell a man he's got himself a problem with some thieves.
5. So, said Don Lorenzo Salvara, you wish me to continue deliberately granting promissory notes to a man that you describe as the most capable thief in Camor?
Respectfully, my lord Salvara, that's what you would have done anyway, even without our intervention.
When Locke spoke, there was no hint of Lucas Fairwhite in his voice or in his mannerisms. There was no trace of the Vardran merchant's restrained energy or stuffy dignity. This new fiction had the fictional backing of the Duke's incontrovertible writ. He was the sort of man who could and would tease a don while invading the sanctity of that don's home. Such audacity could never be faked. Locke had to feel it, summon it from somewhere inside, cloak himself in arrogance as though it were an old familiar garment. Locke Lamora became a shadow in his own mind. He was a Midnighter, an officer in the Duke's silent constabulary. Locke's complicated lies were this new man's simple truth.
The sums discussed could easily total half my available holdings.
Then give our friend Fairwhite half your fortune, my lord. Choke the thorn on exactly what he desires. Promissory notes will tie him down, keep him moving back and forth between counting houses.
Counting houses that will throw my very real money after this phantom, you mean?
Yes, in the service of the Duke, no less. Take heart, my lord Salvara. His grace is entirely capable of compensating you for any loss you incur while aiding us in the capture of this man. In my opinion, though, the thorn will have time to neither spend it nor move it very far, so your stolen money should be recovered before that even becomes necessary. You must also consider the aspects of the situation that are not strictly financial.
Meaning?
His Grace's gratitude for your assistance in bringing this matter to our desired outcome, said Locke, balanced against his certain displeasure if any reluctance on your part should alert our thief to the net drawing tight around him.
Ah. Don Salvara picked his optics up and resettled them on his nose.
With that I can hardly argue.
I will not be able to speak to you in public. No uniformed member of the Camor Watch will approach you for any reason related to this affair. If I speak to you at all, it must be at night, in secret.
Am I to tell Conte to keep refreshments at hand for men coming in through the windows? Shall I tell the Doña Sofia to send any midnighters to my study if they should pop out of her wardrobe closet?
I give you my word, any future appearances will be less alarming, my lord. My instructions were to impress upon you the seriousness of the situation and the full extent of our ability to bypass obstacles. I assure you, I have no personal desire to antagonize you any further. Resecuring your fortune will be the capstone to many months of hard work on my part.
And the Doña Sofia? Has your master dictated a part for her in this counter-charade?
Your wife is a most extraordinary woman. By all means, inform her of our involvement. Tell her the truth about Lucas Fairwhite. Enlist her very capable aid in our endeavor. However,
Locke said, grinning malignantly,
I do believe that I shall regretfully leave you the task of explaining this to her on your own, my lord.
6. On the landward side of Camor, armed men paced the old stone walls of the city, ever vigilant for signs of bandits or hostile armies in the field. On the seaward side, watchtowers and war galleys served the same purpose. At the guard stations on the periphery of the Alchigrante district, the city watch stands ready to protect the city's lesser nobility from the annoyance of having to see or smell any of their actual subjects against their wishes. Locke and Carlo crossed the Angevine just before midnight on the broad glass bridge called the Eldrin Arch. This ornately carved span connected the western Alchigrante with the lush semi-public gardens of Two Silver Green, another spot where the insufficiently well-heeled were discouraged from lingering, often with whips and batons. Tall cylinders of ruby-coloured glass shed alchemical light onto the wispy threads of mist that curled and wavered below the knees of their horses. The centre of the bridge was 50 feet above the water, and the usual night fog reached no higher. The red lamps swayed gently within their black iron frames as the muggy hangman's breeze spun them, and the two gentlemen bastards rode down into the Alchigrante with that eerie light surrounding them like a bloody aura.
"Hold there! State your name and business!"
At the point where the bridge met the Angevine's north shore, there was a low wooden shack with oil-paper windows, through which a pale white glow emanated. A single figure stood beside it, his yellow tabard turned to orange in the light of the bridge lamps. The speaker's words might have been bold, but his voice was young and a little uncertain. Locke smiled. The Alchigrante guard shacks always held two yellow jackets, but at this one the more senior had clearly sent his less hardened partner out into the fog to do the actual work. So much the better. Locke pulled his precious sigil wallet out of his black cloak as his horse cantered down beside the guard station.
"My name is immaterial."
Locke flipped the wallet open to allow the round-faced young city watchman a glimpse of the sigil by the light of his guard station.
"My business is that of His Grace, Duke Nicovante."
I see, sir."
"I never came this way. We did not speak. Be sure that your fellow watchman understands this as well."
The yellow jacket bowed and took a quick step backward, as though afraid to stay too close. Locke smiled. Black-cloaked riders on black horses looming out of darkness and mist. It was easy to laugh at such conceits in full daylight, but night had a way of lending weight to phantasms. If Coin Kisser's Row was where Camor's money was put to use, the Alchigrante district was where it was put to rest. It was four connected islands, each a sort of tiered hill sloping up to the base of the plateau that held the five towers. Old money and new money mingled crazy quilt fashion here in mazes of manor houses and private gardens. Here the merchants and money changers and shipbrokers looked down comfortably on the rest of the city. Here the lesser nobility looked up covetously at the towers of the five families who ruled all. Carriages clattered past from time to time, their black lacquered wooden cabins trailing bobbing lanterns and banners, proclaiming the arms of whoever travelled within. Some of these were guarded by teams of armed outriders in slashed doublets and polished breastplates, this year's fashion for rented thugs. A few teams of horses wore harnesses spotted with miniature alchemical lights. These appeared at a distance, looking like chains of fireflies bobbing in the mist. Don Salvara's manor was a four-story pillared rectangle, several centuries old and sagging a bit under the weight of its years, for it had been built entirely by human hands. It was a sort of island unto itself at the heart of the Isla Durona, westernmost neighbourhood of the Alchegrante, surrounded on all sides by a 12-foot stone wall and enclosed by thick gardens. It shared no party walls with neighbouring manors. Amber lights burned behind the barred windows on the third floor. Locke and Carlo quietly dismounted in the alley adjacent to the manor's northern wall. Several long nights of careful reconnaissance by Locke and Bug had revealed the easiest routes over the alley wall and up the side of the Salvara manor. Dressed as they were, hidden by mist and darkness, they would be effectively invisible as soon as they could hop the outer wall and get off the street. A moment of fortunate stillness fell upon them as Carlo tied the horses to a weathered wooden post beside the garden wall. Not a soul was in sight. Carlo stroked his horse's thin mane.
"Hoist a glass or two in memory of us if we don't come back, love."
Locke put his back against the base of the wall and cupped his hands. Carlo set a foot in this makeshift stirrup and leapt upward, propelled by the mingled strength of his legs and Locke's arms. When he'd hoisted himself quietly and carefully atop the wall, he reached back down with both arms to hoist Locke up. The Sansa twin was as wiry as Locke was slender, and the operation went smoothly. In seconds they were both down in the wet, fragrant darkness of the garden, crouched motionless, listening. The doors on the ground floor were all protected from within by intricate clockwork fail-safes and steel bars. They simply could not be picked. But the rooftop, well, those who weren't yet important enough to live with the constant threat of assassination, often placed an inordinate degree of faith in high walls. The two thieves went up the north face of the manor house, slowly and carefully, wedging hands and feet firmly into chinks in the warm, slick stone. The first and second floors were dark and quiet. The light on the third floor was on the opposite side of the building. Hearts hammering with excitement, they hauled themselves up until they were just beneath the parapet of the roof, where they paused for a long interval, straining to catch at any sound from within the manor that would hint at discovery. The moons were stuffed away behind gauzy grey clouds. On their left, the city was an arc of blurred jewel lights shining through mist, and above them the impossible heights of the five towers stood like black shadows before the sky. The threads of light that burned on their parapets and in their windows enhanced rather than reduced their aura of menace. Staring up at them from near the ground was a sure recipe for vertigo. Locke was the first over the parapet. Peering intently by the faint light falling from above, he planted his feet on a white-tiled pathway in the centre of the roof and kept them there. He was surrounded on either side by the dark shapes of bushes, blossoms, small trees, and vines. The roof was rich with the scent of vegetation and night soil. The street-level garden was a mundane affair, if well tended. This was the Doña Sofia's private botanical preserve. Most alchemical botanists, in Locke's experience, were enthusiasts of bizarre poisons. He made sure his hood and cloak were cinched tight around him and pulled his black neckcloth up over his lower face. Soft stepping along the white path, Locke and Carlo threaded their way through Sophia's garden, more carefully than if they had been walking between streams of lamp oil with their cloaks on fire. At the garden's centre was a roof hatch with a simple tumbler lock. Carlo listened carefully at this door for 2 minutes with his favourite picks poised in his hands. Charming the lock took less than 10 seconds. The fourth floor. Doña Sofia's workshop. A place where the two intruders wanted even less to stumble or linger than they had in her garden. Quiet as guilty husbands coming home from a late night of drinking, They stole through the dark rooms of laboratory apparatus and potted plants, scampering for the narrow stone stairs that led downward to a side passage on the third floor. The operations of the Salvara household were well known to the gentleman bastards. The Don and Donya kept their private chambers on the third floor, across the hall from the Don's study. The second floor was the Sola, a reception and dining hall that went mostly disused when the couple had no friends over to entertain. The first floor held the kitchen, several parlours, and the servants' quarters. In addition to Conte, the Salvaras kept a pair of middle-aged housekeepers, a cook, and a young boy who served as a messenger and scullion. All of them would be asleep on the first floor. None of them posed even a fraction of a threat that Conte did. This was the part of the scheme that couldn't be planned with any precision. They had to locate the old soldier and deal with him before they could have their intended conversation with Don Salvara. Footsteps echoed from somewhere else on the floor. Locke, in the lead, crouched low and peeked around the left-hand corner. It turned out he was looking down the long passage that divided the third floor in half lengthwise. Don Salvara had left the door to his study open and was vanishing into the bedchamber. That door he closed firmly behind him, and a moment later the sound of a metal lock echoed down the hall.
"Serendipity," whispered Locke. "I suspect he'll be busy for quite some time in there. Light's still on in his study, so we know he's coming back out. Let's get the hard part over with."
Locke and Carlo slipped down the hallway, sweating now, but barely letting their heavy cloaks flutter as they moved. The long passage was tastefully decorated with hanging tapestries and shallow wall sconces in which tiny glow-glasses shed no more light than that of smouldering coals. Behind the heavy doors to the Salvara's chambers, someone laughed. The stairwell at the far end of the passage was wide and circular, steps of white marble inset with mosaic tile maps of Camor spiraled down into the solar. Here Carlo grabbed Locke by one sleeve, put a finger to his lips, and jerked his head downward.
"Listen,"
he murmured. Clang, clang. Footsteps. Clang, clang. The sequence of noises was repeated several times, growing slightly louder each time. Locke grinned at Carlo. Someone was pacing the solar, methodically checking the locks and the iron bars guarding each window. At this time of the night, there was only one man in the house who'd be doing such a thing. Carlo knelt beside the balustrade, just to the left of the top of the staircase. Anyone coming up the spiral stairs would have to pass directly beneath this position. He reached inside his cloak and took out a folded leather sack and a length of narrow-gauge rope woven from black silk. He then began to thread the silk line through and around the sack in some arcane fashion that Locke couldn't follow. Locke knelt just behind Carlo and kept one eye on the long passage they'd come down. A reappearance of the Don was hardly likely yet, but the benefactor was said to make colourful examples of incautious thieves. Conte's light, steady footsteps echoed on the staircase beneath them. In a fair fight, the Don's man would almost certainly paint the walls with Locke and Carlo's blood, so it stood to reason that this fight would have to be as unfair as possible. At the moment the top of Conte's bald head appeared beneath him, Carlo reached out between the balustrade posts and let his crimper's hood drop. A crimper's hood, for those who've never had the occasion to be kidnapped and sold into slavery in one of the cities on the Iron Sea, looks a bit like a tent as it flutters quickly downward, borne by weights sewn into its bottom edges. Air pushes its flaps outward just before it drops down around its target's head and settles on his shoulders. Conte gave a startled jerk as Carlo yanked the black silk cord, instantly cinching the hood closed around his neck. Anyone with any real presence of mind could probably reach up and fumble such a hood loose in a matter of seconds, which is why the interior is inevitably painted with large amounts of some sweet-scented fuming narcotic purchased from a black apothecary. Knowing the nature of the man they were attempting to subdue, Locke and Carlo had spent nearly 30 crowns on the stuff Conte was breathing just now, and Locke fervently wished him much joy of it. One panic breath inside the airtight hood, that would be enough to drop any ordinary person in his or her tracks. But as Locke flew down the stairs to catch Conte's body, he saw that the man was still somehow upright, clawing at the hood, disoriented and weakened, most definitely, but still awake. A quick rap on the solar plexus, that would open his mouth and speed the drug on its way. Locke stepped in to deliver the blow, wrapping one hand around Conte's neck just beneath the crimper's hood. This nearly blew the entire game. Conte's arms flashed up and broke Locke's lackadaisical chokehold before it even began. The man's left arm snaked out to entangle Locke's right, and then Conte punched him. Once, twice, three times. Vicious jabs in his own stomach and solar plexus. With his guts an exploding constellation of pain, Locke sank down against his would-be victim, struggling for balance. Conte brought his right knee up in a blow that should have knocked Locke's teeth out of his ears at high speed, but the drug was finally, thankfully, smothering the old soldier's will to be ornery. The knee barely grazed Locke's chin. Instead, the booted foot attached to it caught him in the groin and knocked him backward. His head bounced against the hard marble of the stairs, somewhat cushioned by the cloth of his hood. Locke lay there, gasping for breath, still hanging awkwardly by one of the hooded man's arms. Carlo appeared at that instant, having dropped the line that cinched his crimper's hood and dashed down the stairs. He slipped one foot behind Conte's increasingly wobbly legs and pushed the man down the stairs, holding him by the front of his doublet to keep the fall relatively quiet. Once Conte was head down and prone, Carlo punched him rather mercilessly between the legs. Once, then again when the man's legs twitched feebly, and then again, which yielded no response. The hood had finally done its work. With Conte temporarily disposed of, Carlo turned to Locke and tried to help him to a sitting position, but Locke waved him off.
"What sort of state are you in?" Carlo whispered. "As though I'm with child and the little bastard is trying to cut his way out with an axe!"
Chest heaving, Locke tore his black mask down off his face, lest he vomit inside it and create an unconcealable mess. While Locke gulped deep breaths and tried to control his shuddering, Carlo crouched back down beside Conte and tore the hood off, briskly waving away the sickly sweet aroma of the leather bag's contents. He carefully folded the hood up, slipped it into his cloak, and then dragged Conte up a few steps.
"Carlo!"
Locke coughed.
"My disguise! Damaged? Not that I can see. Looks like he didn't do anything that shows, provided you can walk without a slouch. Stay here a moment."
Carlo slipped down to the foot of the stairs and took a peek around the darkened solar. Soft city light fell through the barred windows, faintly illuminating a long table and a number of glass cases on the walls, holding plates and unidentifiable knick-knacks. Not another soul was in sight, and not a sound could be heard from below. When Carlo returned, Locke had pushed himself up on his knees and hands. Conte slumbered beside him with a look of comical bliss on his craggy face.
"Oh, he's not going to keep that expression when he wakes up."
Carlo waved a pair of thin, leather-padded brass knuckles at Locke, then made them vanish up his sleeves with a graceful flourish.
"I had my foot pads little friends on when I knocked him around that last time. Well, I for one have no expressions of sympathy to spare, since he kicked my balls hard enough to make them permanent residents of my lungs."
Locke tried to push himself up off his hands and failed. Carlo caught him under his right arm and eased him up until he was kneeling shakily on his knees alone.
"You've got your breath back at least. Can you actually walk?" "I can stumble, I think. I'll be hunched over for a while. Give me a few minutes, and I think I can pretend nothing's wrong, at least until we're out of here."
Carlo assisted Locke back up the stairs to the third floor. Leaving Locke there to keep watch, he then began to quietly, slowly drag Conte up the same way. The Don's man didn't actually weigh all that much. Embarrassed and eager to make himself useful again, Locke pulled two lengths of tough cord out of his own cloak and bound Conte's feet and hands with them. He folded a handkerchief three times and used it as a gag. Locke pulled Conte's knives out of their sheaths and passed them to Carlo, who stashed them within his cloak. The Don's study door still hung open, shedding warm light into the passage. The bedchamber doors remained locked tight.
"I pray you both may be gifted with a demand and an endurance well beyond your usual expectations, my lord and lady," whispered Carlo. "Your household thieves would appreciate a short break before continuing with their duties for the evening."
Carlo grasped Conte beneath his arms, and Locke, slouched in obvious pain, nonetheless grabbed the man's feet when Carlo began to drag him all by himself. With tedious stealth, they retraced their steps and deposited the unconscious bodyguard around the far bend in the corridor, just beside the stairs leading back up to the fourth-floor laboratories. The Don's study was a most welcome sight when they finally stole in a few minutes later. Locke settled into a deeply cushioned leather armchair on the left-hand wall, while Carlo took up a standing guard position. More laughter could be heard faintly from across the hall.
"We could be here quite a while," said Carlo.
"The gods are merciful."
Locke stared at the Don's tall glass-fronted liquor cabinet, one even more impressive than the collection his pleasure barge carried.
"I'd pour us a draught of six, but I don't think it would be in character."
They waited 10 minutes, 15, 20. Locke breathed steadily and deeply, and concentrated on ignoring the throbbing ache that seemed to fill his guts from top to bottom. Yet when the two thieves heard the door across the hallway unbolting, Locke leapt to his feet, standing tall, pretending that his balls didn't feel like clay jugs dropped onto cobblestones from a great height. He cinched his black mask back on and willed a wave of perfect arrogance to claim him from the inside out. As Father Chains had once said, the best disguises were those that were poured out of the heart rather than painted on the face. Carlo kissed the back of his left hand through his own mask and winked. Don Lorenzo Salvara walked into his study whistling, lightly dressed and completely unarmed.
"Close the door," said Locke, and his voice was steady, rich with the absolute presumption of command. "Have a seat, my lord, and don't bother calling for your man. He is indisposed."
7. An hour past midnight, two men left the Alcigrante district via the Eldrin Arch. They wore black cloaks and had black horses. One of them rode with a leisurely air, while the other led his horse on foot, walking in a curiously bow-legged fashion.
"Unfucking believable," said Carlo. "It really did work out just as you planned. It's a pity we can't brag about this to anyone. Our biggest score ever, and all we had to do was tell our mark exactly what we were doing to him."
"And get kicked around a bit," muttered Locke.
"Yeah, sorry about that. What a beast that man was, eh? Take comfort that he'll feel the same way when he opens his eyes again."
How very comforting. If reassurances could dull pain, nobody would ever go to the trouble of pressing grapes.
"By the crooked warden, I never heard such self-pity dripping from the mouth of a wealthy man. Cheer up! Richer and cleverer than everyone else, right?"
"Richer and cleverer and walking funny, yes."
The pair of thieves made their way south through Two Silver Green, toward the first of the stops where they would gradually lose their horses and shed their black clothes, until they were finally heading back to the temple district dressed as common laborers. They nodded companionably at patrols of yellow jackets, stomping about in the mist with lanterns swaying on pike poles to light their way. Not once were they given any reason to glance up. The fluttering shadow that trailed them on their way through the streets and alleys was quieter than a small child's breath. Swift and graceful, it swooped from rooftop to rooftop in their wake, following their actions with absolute single-mindedness. When they slipped back into the temple district, it beat its wings and rose into the darkness in a lazy, spiraling circle, until it was up above the mists of Camor and lost against the grey haze of the low-hanging clouds. Interlude. The Last Mistake. 1. Locke's first experience with the mirror wine of Tal Verar had even more of an effect on the boy's malnourished body than Chains had expected. Locke spent most of the next day tossing and turning on his cot, his head pounding and his eyes unable to bear anything but the most gentle spark of light.
"It's a fever,"
Locke muttered into his sweat-soaked blanket.
"It's a hangover."
Chains ran a hand through the boy's hair and patted his back.
"My fault, really. The Sansa twins are natural liquor sponges. I shouldn't have let you live up to their standard on your first night with us. No work for you today."
"Liquor does this, even after you're sober?"
"A cruel joke, isn't it? The gods put a price tag on everything, it seems, unless you're drinking Osterschellen brandy."
"Osterschellen?"
"Osterschellen, from Emberlane. Among its many other virtues, it doesn't cause a hangover. Some sort of alchemical component in the vineyard soil. Expensive stuff."
False light came after many hours of half-sleep, and Locke found himself able to walk once again, though the brain within his skull felt like it was attempting to dig a hole down through his neck and escape. Chains insisted that they would still be visiting Kappa Barsavi.
"The only people who break appointments with him are the ones that live in glass towers and have their pictures on coins, and even they think twice."
Though he consented to allow Locke a more comfortable means of transportation. It turned out that the House of Perelandro had a small stable tucked around the back, and in this smelly little stall there lived a gentled goat.
"He's got no name,"
Chains said, as he set Locke atop the creature's back.
"I just couldn't bring myself to give him one, since he wouldn't answer to it anyway."
Locke had never developed the instinctive revulsion most boys and girls felt for gentled animals. He'd already seen too much ugliness in his life to care about the occasional empty stare from a docile, milky-eyed creature. There is a substance called wraithstone, a chalky white material found in certain remote mountain caverns. The stuff doesn't occur naturally. It is found only in conjunction with glass-lined tunnels, presumably abandoned by the Eldrin, the same unsettling race that built Camor ages past. In its solid state, wraithstone is tasteless, nearly odorless, and inert. It must be burned to activate its unique properties. Physicists have begun to identify the various means and channels by which poisons attack the bodies of the living. This one stills the heart, while this one thins the blood, and still others damage the stomach or the intestines. Wraithstone smoke poisons nothing physical. What it does is burn out personality itself. Ambition, stubbornness, pluck, spirit, drive, all of these things fade with just a few breaths of the arcane haze. Accidental exposure to small amounts can leave a man listless for weeks. Anything more than that, and the effect will be permanent. Victims remain alive, but entirely unconcerned by anything. They don't respond to their names, or to their friends, or to mortal danger. They can be prodded into eating or excreting or carrying something, and little else. The pale white sheen that fills their eyes is an outward expression of the emptiness that takes hold in their hearts and minds. Once, in the time of the Therin throne, the process was used to punish criminals, but it has been centuries since any civilized Therin city-state allowed the use of wraithstone on men and women. A society that still hangs children for petty theft and feeds prisoners to sea creatures finds the results too disquieting to bear. Gentling, therefore, is reserved for animals, mostly beasts of burden intended for urban service. The cramped confines of a hazard-rich city like Camor are ideally suited to the process. Gentled ponies may be trusted never to throw the children of the wealthy. Gentled horses and mules may be trusted never to kick their handlers or dump expensive cargoes into a canal. A burlap sack with a bit of the white stone and a slow smouldering match is placed over an animal's muzzle, and the human handlers retreat to fresh air. A few minutes later, the creature's eyes are the color of new milk, and it will never do anything on its own initiative again. But Locke had a throbbing headache, and he was just getting used to the idea that he was a murderer and a resident of a private glass fairyland, and the eerily mechanical behavior of his goat didn't bother him at all. "This temple will be exactly where I left it when I return later this evening," said Father Chains as he finished dressing for his venture outside. The eyeless priest had vanished entirely, to be replaced by a hale man of middle years and moderate means. His beard and his hair had been touched up with some sort of brown dye. His vest and cheap cotton-lined half-cloak hung loosely over a cream-coloured shirt with no ties or cravats.
"Exactly where you left it," said one of the Sansas. "And not burned down or anything," said the other.
"If you boys can burn down stone and elderglass, the gods have higher aspirations for you than a place as my apprentices. Do behave. I'm taking Locke to get his, Chains glanced sideways at the Lamora boy. He then mimed taking a drink and held his jaw afterward as though in pain.
"Oh,"
said Carlo and Galdo in pitch-perfect unison. "Indeed." Chains settled a little round leather cap on his head and took the reins of Locke's goat. "Wait up for us. This should be interesting, to say the least." 2.
"This Kappa Barsavi," Locke said as
Chains led the nameless goat across one of the narrow glass arches between the Fauna and Coin Kisser's Row.
"My old master told me about him, I think."
"You're quite right. That time you got the elderglass vine burned down, I believe."
"Ah, you know about that."
"Well, once your old master started telling me about you, he just sort of didn't shut up for several hours."
"If I'm your peasant, are you Barsavi's peasant?"
"That's a plain, neat description of our relationship, yes. All the right people are Barsavi's soldiers. His eyes, his ears, his agents, his subjects, his peasant. Barsavi is a particular sort of friend. I did some things for him back when he was coming to power. We rose together, you might say. I got special consideration and he got the, entire city."
"Special consideration?"
It was as pleasant a night for a stroll as Camor ever produced during the summer. A hard rain had fallen not an hour before, and the fresh mist that spread its tendrils around buildings like the grasping hands of spectral giants was slightly cooler than usual, and its odor wasn't yet saturated with the redolence of silt and dead fish and human waste. Other people were few and far between on Coin Kisser's Row after false light, so Locke and Chains spoke fairly freely. "I've got the distance, which means, well, there are 100 gangs in Camor, Locke. 100 and more. Certainly I can't remember them all. Some of them are too new or too unruly for Kappa Barsavi to trust them as well as he might. So he keeps a close eye on them. Insists on frequent reports, plants men in them, reins their actions in tightly. Those of us that don't suffer such scrutiny," Chains pointed to himself, then to Locke, "are sort of presumed to be doing things honestly until proven otherwise. We follow his rules and pay him a cut of our take, and he thinks he can more or less trust us to get it right. No audits, no spies, no bullshit. The distance, it's a privilege worth paying for." Chains stuck a hand in one of his cloak pockets. There was the pleasing jingle of coins. "I've got a little show of respect for him right here, in fact. 2/10 of this week's take from the charity kettle of Perelandro." More than 100 gangs, you said?
This city has more gangs than it has foul odors, boy. Some of them are older than many families on the Alchigrante, and some of them have stricter rituals than some of the priestly orders. Hell, at one point, there were nearly 30 coppers, and each one had 4 or 5 gangs under his thumb.
30 coppers? All like Coppa Barsavi?
Yes and no. Yes, that they ran gangs and gave orders and cut men open from cock to eyeballs when they got angry. No, that they were anything like Barsavi otherwise. 5 years ago, there were 30 bosses I talked about. 30 little kingdoms, all fighting and thieving and spilling each other's guts in the street. All at war with the Yellow Jackets, who used to kill 20 men a week, in slow weeks. Then Coppa Barsavi walked in from Tal Varar. Used to be a scholar at the Therin Collegium, if you can believe it. Taught rhetoric. He got a few gangs under his thumb, and he started cutting. Not like a back-alley slasher, but more like a physica cutting out a canker. When Barsavi took out another Coppa, he took their gangs, too. But he didn't lean on them if he didn't have to. He gave them full territories and let them choose their own garistas, and he cut them in on his take. So, 5 years ago, there were 30. 4 years ago, there were 10. 3 years ago, there was 1. Coppa Barsavi and his 100 gangs. The whole city, all the right people, present company included, in his pocket. No more open war across the bloody canals. No more platoons of thieves getting strung up all at once at the Palace of Patience. Nowadays they have to do them 2 or 3 at a time.
Because of the secret peace, the one I broke?
The one you broke, yes. Good guess, presuming I'd know about that. Yes, my boy, it's the key to Barsavi's peculiar success. What it comes down to is, he has a standing agreement with the Duke, handled through one of the Duke's agents. The gangs of Camor don't touch the nobles. We don't lay a finger on ships or drays or crates that have a legitimate coat of arms on them. In exchange, Barsavi is the actual ruler of a few of the city's more charming points. Catchfire, the Narrows, the Dregs, the Wooden Waste, the Snare, and parts of the docks. Plus the city watch is much more relaxed than they ought to be.
So we can rob anyone who isn't a noble?
Or a yellow jacket, yes. We can have the merchants and the money changers and the incoming and the outgoing. There's more money passing through Camor than any other city on this coast, boy. Hundreds of ships a week, thousands of sailors and officers. We don't have any problem laying off the nobility.
Doesn't that make the merchants and the money changers and the other people angry?
It might if they knew about it. That's why there's that word secret in front of peace. And that's why Camor's such a lovely, fine, safe place to live. You really only need to worry about losing your money if you don't have much of it in the first place.
Oh, said Locke, fingering his little shark's tooth necklace. Okay, but now I wonder, you said my old master bought and paid for, killing me. Will you get in trouble with Barsavi for not killing me?
Chains laughed. Why would I be taking you to see him if that'd get me in trouble, boy? No, the death mark's mine to use or not, as I see fit. I bought it, don't you see? He doesn't care if we actually use him, only that we acknowledge that the power of granting life or death is his. Sort of like a tax only he can collect, you see?
Locke nodded, then allowed himself to be trundled along silently for a few minutes, absorbing all of this. His aching head made the scale of what was going on a bit difficult to grasp.
"Let me tell you a story," said Father Chains after a while.
A story that will let you know just what sort of man you're going to meet and swear fealty to this evening. Once upon a time, when Kappa Barsavi's hold on the city was very new and very delicate, it was an open secret that a pack of his garistas was plotting to get rid of him just as soon as the chance presented itself. And they were very alert for his countermoves, see? They'd helped him take over the city, and they knew how he worked. So they made sure he couldn't get all of them at once. If he tried to cut some throats, the gangs would scatter and warn each other, and it'd be a bloody mess, another long war. He made no open moves, and the rumors of their disloyalty got worse. Kappa Barsavi would receive visitors in his hall. It's still out there in the wooden waste. It used to be a big Ferrari hulk, one of those fat, wide galleons they used for hauling troops. It's just anchored there now, a sort of makeshift palace. He calls it the Floating Grave. Well, at the Floating Grave, he made a big show of putting down this one large carpet from Ashmere. A really lovely thing. The sort of cloth the Duke would hang on a wall for safekeeping. And he made sure that everyone around him knew how much he liked that carpet. It got so that his court could tell what he was going to do to a visitor by watching that carpet. If there was going to be blood, that carpet would be rolled up and packed away safe. Without exception. Months went by. Carpet up, carpet down. Sometimes men who got called to see him would try to run the moment they saw bare floor beneath his feet, which of course was as good as admitting wrongdoing out loud. Anyhow, back to his problem garistas. Not one of them was stupid enough to enter the Floating Grave without a gang at their back, or to be caught alone with Barsavi. His rule was still too uncertain at this point for him to just throw a tantrum about it, so he waited. And then one night he invited 9 of his troublesome garistas to dinner. Not all the troublemakers, of course, but the cleverest and the toughest and the ones with the biggest gangs. And their spies brought back word that that lovely embroidered carpet, the Kappa's prize possession, was rolled out on the floor for everyone to see, with a banquet table on top of it and more food than the gods themselves had ever seen. So those stupid bastards, they figured Barsavi was serious, that he really wanted to talk. They thought he was scared, and they expected negotiations in good faith. So they didn't bring their gangs or make alternate plans. They thought they'd won. "You can imagine," said Chains, "just how surprised they were when they sat down at their chairs on that beautiful carpet, and 50 of Barsavi's men piled into the room with crossbows and shot those poor idiots so full of bolts that a porcupine in heat would have taken any one of them home and fucked him. If there was a drop of blood that wasn't on the carpet, it was on the ceiling. You get my meaning?"
"So the carpet was ruined?"
"And then some. Barsavi knew how to create expectations, Locke, and how to use those expectations to mislead those who would harm him. They figured his strange obsession was a guarantee of their lives. Turns out there are just some enemies numerous enough and powerful enough to be worth losing a damn carpet over." Chains pointed ahead of them and to the south. "That's the man waiting to talk to you about 1/2 mile that way. I would strongly recommend cultivating a civil tongue." 3. The last mistake was a place where the underworld of Camor bubbled to the surface, a flat-out crook's tavern where right people of every sort could drink and speak freely of their business, where respectable citizens stood out like serpents in a nursery and were quickly escorted out the door by mean-looking, thick-armed men with very small imaginations. Here entire gangs would come to drink and arrange jobs and just show themselves off. In their cups, men would argue loudly about the best way to strangle someone from behind and the best sorts of poisons to use in wine or food. they would openly proclaim the folly of the Duke's court, or his taxation schemes, or his diplomatic arrangements with the other cities of the Iron Sea. They would refight entire battles with dice and fragments of chicken bones as their armies, loudly announcing how they would have turned left when Duke Nicovante had gone right, how they would have stood fast when the 5,000 blackened iron spears of the Mad Count's rebellion had come surging down Godsgate Hill toward them. But not one of them, no matter how far doused in liquor or gaze or the strange narcotic powders of Jerem, no matter what feats of generalship or statecraft he credited himself with the foresight to bring off, would dare suggest to Capa Vencarlo Barsavi that he should ever change so much as a single button on his waistcoat. 4. The Broken Tower is a landmark of Camor, jutting 90 feet skyward at the very northern tip of the Snare, that low and crowded district where sailors from 100 ports of call are passed from bar to alehouse to gaming den and back again on a nightly basis. They are shaken through a sieve of tavern keepers, whores, muggers, dicers, cobblecogs, and other low tricksters until their pockets are as empty as their heads are heavy, and they can be dumped on ship to nurse their new hangovers and diseases. They come in like the tide and go out like the tide, leaving nothing but a residue of copper and silver, and occasionally blood, to mark their passing. Although human arts are inadequate to the task of cracking elder glass, the Broken Tower was found in its current state when humans first settled Camor, stealing in among the ruins of an older civilization. Great gashes mar the alien glass and stone of the tower's upper stories. These discontinuities have been somewhat covered over with wood and paint and other human materials. The sturdiness of the whole affair is hardly in question, but the repairs are not beautiful, and the rooms for let on the upper 6 floors are some of the least desirable in the city, as they are accessible only by rank upon rank of narrow, twisting exterior stairs, a spindly wooden frame that sways nauseatingly in high winds. Most of the residents are young bravos from various gangs, to whom the insane accommodations are a strange badge of honour. The last mistake fills the first floor at the wide base of the Broken Tower, and after the fall of false light, it rarely has less than 100 patrons in it at any given time. Locke clung tightly to the back of Father Chain's half-cloak as the older man elbowed his way past the crowd at the door. The outward exhalation of the bar's air was full of smells Locke knew quite well. 100 kinds of liquors and the breath of the men and women drinking them, sweat both stale and fresh, piss and vomit, spiced pomanders and wet wool, the sharp bite of ginger and the acrid fog of tobacco.
"Can we trust that boy to watch our goat?"
Locke cried above the din.
"Of course, of course."
Chains made some elaborate hand sign in greeting to a group of men arm-wrestling just inside the bar's main room. Those not locked in bitter struggles grinned and waved back.
"First, it's his job. Second, I paid well. Third, only a crazy person would want to steal a gentled goat."
The last mistake was a sort of monument to the failure of human artifice at critical moments. Its walls were covered in a bewildering variety of souvenirs, each one telling a visual tale that ended with the phrase, "not quite good enough." Above the bar was a full suit of armour, a square hole punched through at the left breast by a crossbow quarrel. Broken swords and split helmets covered the walls, along with fragments of oars, masts, spars, and tatters of sails. One of the bar's proudest claims was that it had secured a memento of every ship that had foundered within sight of Camor in the past 70 years. Into this mess Father Chains dragged Locke Lamora, like a launch being towed at the stern of a huge galleon. On the south wall of the bar was an elevated alcove, given privacy by rows of partially drawn curtains. Men and women stood at attention here, their hard eyes constantly sweeping across the crowd, their hands never far from the weapons they carried openly and ostentatiously. Daggers, darts, brass and wooden clubs, short swords, hatchets, and even crossbows, ranging from slender alley pieces to big horse murderers that looked, to Locke's wide eyes, as though they could knock holes in stone. One of these guards stopped Father Chains, and the two exchanged a few whispered words. Another guard was dispatched into the curtained alcove, while the first eyed Chains warily. A few moments later, the second guard reappeared and beckoned. Thus it was that Locke was led for the first time into the presence of Vencarlo Barsavi, Kappa of Camor, who sat in a plain chair beside a plain table. Several minions stood against the wall behind him, close enough to respond to a summons, but far enough to be out of earshot for quiet conversation. Barsavi was a big man, as wide as Chains, but obviously a bit younger. His oiled black hair was pulled tight behind his neck, and his beards curved off his chin like three braided whipcords of hair, one atop the other, neatly layered. These beards flew about when Barsavi turned his round head, and they looked quite thick enough to sting if they struck bare skin. Barsavi was dressed in a coat, vest, breeches, and boots of some odd dark leather that seemed unusually thick and stiff even to Locke's untrained eyes. After a moment, the boy realized it must be shark hide. The strangely uneven white buttons that dotted his vest and his cuffs and held his layered red silk cravats in place, they were human teeth. Sitting on Barsavi's lap, staring intently at Locke, was a girl about his own age, with short, tangled dark hair and a heart-shaped face. She, too, wore a curious outfit. Her dress was white embroidered silk, fit for any noble's daughter, while the little boots that dangled beneath her hem were black leather, shod with iron, bearing sharpened steel kicking spikes at the heels and the toes. "So this is the boy," said Barsavi, in a deep, slightly nasal voice with the pleasant hint of a Ferrari accent. "The industrious little boy who so confounded our dear thief-maker." "The very one, Your Honour, now happily confounding myself and my other wards." Chains reached behind himself and pushed Locke out from behind his legs. "May I present Locke Lamora, late of Shades Hill, now an initiate of Perelandro?" "Or some god, anyway, eh?" Barsavi chuckled and held out a small wooden box that had been resting on the table near his arm. "It's always nice to see you when your sight miraculously returns, Chains. Have a smoke. Their Jeremite Blackroot, extra fine, just rolled this week." "I can't say no to that, Ven." Chains accepted a tightly rolled sheaf of tobacco in red paper. While the two men bent over a flickering taper to light up, Chains dropped his little bag of coins on the table at the same time, the girl seemed to come to some sort of decision about Locke.
"He's a very ugly little boy, Father. He looks like a skeleton."
Kappa Barsavi coughed out his first few puffs of smoke, the corners of his mouth crinkling upward.
"And you're a very inconsiderate little girl, my dear."
The Kappa drew on his sheaf once more and exhaled a straight stream of translucent smoke. The stuff was pleasantly mellow and carried the slightest hint of burnt vanilla.
"You must forgive my daughter Nazca. I am helpless to deny her indulgences, and she has acquired the manners of a pirate princess, particularly now that we are all afraid to come near her deadly new boots."
"I am never unarmed," said the little girl, kicking up her heels a few times to emphasize the point.
"And poor Locke most certainly is not ugly, my darling. What he bears is clearly the mark of Shades Hill. A month in Chain's keeping, and he'll be as round and fit as a catapult stone."
"Hmm."
The girl continued to stare down at him for a few seconds, then suddenly looked up at her father, absently toying with one of his braided beards while she did so.
"Are you making him a peasant, Father?"
"Chains and I did have that in mind, sweetling, yes."
"Hmm. Then I want another brandy while you're doing the ceremony."
Kappa Barsavi's eyes narrowed. Seams deepened by habitual suspicion drew in around his flinty grey stare.
"You've already had your two brandies for the night, darling. Your mother will murder me if I let you have another. Ask one of the men to get you a beer."
"But I prefer..."
"What you prefer, little tyrant, has nothing to do with what I am telling you. For the rest of the night, you can drink beer or air. The choice is entirely yours."
"I'll have beer, then."
Barsavi reached out to lift her down, but she hopped off his lap just ahead of his thick-fingered, heavily calloused hands. Her heels went clack, clack, clack on the hardwood floor of the alcove as she ran to some minion to give her order.
"And if just one more of my men gets kicked in the shin, darling, you're going to wear reed sandals for a month, I promise."
Barsavi shouted after her, then took another drag of tobacco and turned back to lock and chains.
"She's a keg of fire oil, that one. Last week she refused to sleep at all unless we let her keep a little garrote under her pillows.
Just like Daddy's bodyguards," she said.
"I don't think her brothers yet realize that the next Kappa Barsavi might wear summer dresses and bonnets."
"I can see why you might have been amused by the thief-maker's stories about our boy here,"
Chains said, clasping both of Locke's shoulders as he spoke.
"Of course, I have become very hard to shock since my children grew above the tops of my knees. But you're not here to discuss them. You've brought me this little man so he can take his first and last oath as a peasant. A few years early, it seems. Come here, Locke."
Kappa Barsavi reached out with his right hand and turned Locke's head slightly upward by the chin, staring down into Locke's eyes as he spoke.
"How old are you, Locke Lamora? 6? 7? Already responsible for a breach of the peace, a burnt-down tavern, and 6 or 7 deaths?"
The Kappa smirked.
"I have assassins 5 times your age who should be so bold. Has Chains told you the way it is with my city and my laws?"
Locke nodded.
"You know that once you take this oath, I can't go easy on you ever again. You've had your time to be reckless. If Chains needs to put you down, he will. If I tell him to put you down, he will."
Again, Locke nodded. Nazca returned to her father's side, sipping from a tarred leather ale jack. She stared at Locke over the rim of this drinking vessel,